joining me in the KRVS studios this afternoon, I'm very happy to say, is artist Dawn Dido. She has an exhibit that will open this Saturday during Second Saturday Art Walk at the Acadiana Center for the Arts in the main gallery. Dawn has been working in Louisiana for decades now, was one of the first artists in Louisiana working with electronic technology, and is also a pioneer in immersive art, which we expect now to see immersive art. But when you first started working in it, immersing people surrounded by screens and gadgetry, and that was very unique. That was very revolutionary here in Louisiana when you first started working in it. So I'd like to talk a bit about your history before we get to this exhibit, which opens at the ACA. It is called Mothership, Dreaming of a Future Past, and it is phase two of an evolving exhibit that will culminate in New Orleans in the fall. So again, welcome to our studios.
Thank you so much. So pleased to be here and be in Lafayette.
Well, Dawn, tell us a bit about how you got started in this multimedia format. What attracted you to it when you first started working, I guess, in the 70s? Where did you encounter it first?
Well, I was I studied fine arts, and I was a painter. And I guess I got caught up also in McLuhan theory, Global Village. I got very interested equally in mass communication theory and how mass communications would shape our society as it evolved.
And you're talking about Marshall McLuhan.
Yes.
Okay. For those people.
And in addition to studying painting, I started a side study in communication theory. And my first professional works actually combine my two interests. And I used media, mass media, as the medium. And a first early piece was CB radio booths. I got AT&T to give me some outdoor telephone housing units and gutted them and transformed them into CBs. Got the highway to give me permission to put highway signage up, CB radio booth next exit, control tower at One Shell Square in New Orleans, and had people speaking for several months. I was interested, and this is preceding internet, how this became a very democratic medium, because you have people of different socioeconomic racial backgrounds speaking equally and unknowingly of the other's background. So I like that. And
so place that in time for those people who don't remember CB radios or never used them. About what time is that?
I think this piece was in 1975.
Okay.
And then it culminated with a meeting point, and everyone came to meet who they had been speaking with. I was interested also in the evolution of new language, much as we have abbreviated text now with, God forbid, tweeting and things like this. But it's the evolution of communication and symbolism and iconographic okay, you get it.
Yeah. Well, but that is fascinating. And you have continued using the evolving technologies, starting with those CB radios, which I guess for some people what they think of is that, you know, that sort of breaker. You
know, right.
Truckers using that. But as you said, it really allowed so many people to communicate with each other on that vast network of communication, the interstate highways that we have here in our country as well.
I thought it was great that you had people really wanting to speak, and it did break down the barriers.
Mm-hmm. So physically, what did some of your early works, if people go to your website and look at them, you can't describe any one way your works are, but describe some of those early pieces, how you would install those in spaces.
Well, the CBs, for instance, I would install. They were mobile, so I'd put them in different locations along roadways or in downtown or in industrial sites or strip malls. So those would move around, give them 2 weeks here, 2 weeks there. And then the photo documentation and the sound became another layer of the art. But the big art was when everyone came together. Then another piece, Drive-Up Movie, had a projector, large outdoor projector from a movie theater and a generator, and would drive around South Louisiana projecting films. This was in 75, 76. And again, it was trying to take art outside of the confines of the museum and bring it into neighborhoods and into places where art did not yet serve audience. And it was about community engagement and building audience. And then ended up actually working for the New Orleans Museum of Art for a while, trying to help them break down the barriers because it had been closed, for instance, to African Americans in the mid-20th century and prior. And so they were trying to open the doors and build audience. And so I did a lot of work using art projects to broaden the base.
So you were, even though you were taking your art outside into communities, you were working within the museums as well to try and bridge that gap. And your work has been shown in museums around the country, the Whitney Museum and many contemporary, very well-known contemporary museums around the country. Your work has been shown. So obviously there is a place more and more for installation pieces within museums. And I think some people, again, not familiar with art perhaps, don't understand how that fits alongside what we think of as traditional art in the museum that hangs on the wall and maybe you change it out every once in a while. And I think most of all what they have a hard time with is understanding how that remains, that as someone who works in media, multimedia, how your art remains within the body of art. Like when you install something like the CB radio, how does that remain in our consciousness and in the history of art?
Well, I think the object and the sound can be an artifact. In this case, the artifacts were lost in a fire, but they can survive. And I think if you look at museums now and what they're collecting of from that period of time, there are examples of electronic arts and conceptual projects. The artifacts, particularly MoMA, Museum of Modern Art in New York, in some of their recent shows with a new curator whose name I can't remember at the moment, but I think she, I know it's a woman, has done a good job of incorporating this type of document into the body of artifact, art artifact. Mm-hmm. But for me, it's not always turning to the communication conceptual piece. Sometimes it is making actually true two-dimensional or three-dimensional objects. And as you pointed out, I did take a long-term interest in trying to create 360-degree environments out of film, virtual environments. And that was a wonderful challenge. Of course, when I was doing it, very expensive. It's gotten a lot cheaper now and more magical. And I, for one, don't like to show my hand. I want it to be really about the experience, less than putting the gizmos right in your face. I want it to be kind of magical.
That immersive sense,
yes,
of it, where you walk into it.
Yes.
Well, let's talk about some of your concepts that have grown over the years and get us up to mothership and where that fits into your work. You talked about early on being very interested in communication and bringing art to people who had not experienced art before. But over the decades, how have your interests grown in your concepts? Well, what has really shaped you as an artist over the past few decades?
Well, I do think that I am a public artist with a capital P. I'm very interested in connecting with my audiences. I appreciate studio artists who are aesthetes and making pure beauty. I admire that, but I can't just do that. So it's important for me to connect. I think my earliest interests were certainly more in the area of sociology, in class and race and gender, and trying to break down barriers in that regard, and particularly had a long focus in race relations. Then moved out of that into, I'll say now, I'll skip a few topics, but I think certainly in the last 10 years, I have a very strong interest in the environment and what can I do in art without being preachy, without allowing it to become educational and not art, not lose its power. How can I be both an activist and an artist? And I think we have some facing challenges here. I think here in Louisiana, we are on the front line of the abyss. And I think people around the world are turning to us. And it's our opportunity to offer leadership and courage and to take action, and I want to be a part of that. So I think mothership comes out of works that I did. I did a big series after the BP oil spill, did a big series, of course, after Katrina, and it's about loss and also about the possibility of hope that we do have within our hands right now, within our scope of possibilities. We have the last shreds of hope and potential to change things. It's really right now.
Well, as you said, it's very interesting to be in Louisiana at this time because the change in environment is not theoretical as it is for some people. We see the coast and we see things affecting the coast, whether it's hurricanes or spills. And of course, people are asking those questions about where is the hope? What can we do? They're very keen to grapple with that and think about it. So your work is it's extremely timely. So, but you have been interested in this idea of environment in art before Katrina, even.
Yes. But it's grown. It's accelerated. And as I said somewhere, it's not that I'm a fatalist, but I do feel a sense of urgency, and I do want to be a part of. Maybe turning things around.
Well, in addition to expressing it through art, you have a real interest in the science and the numbers behind what's happening and what will happen. Now, you expressed your interest in communications earlier on, but how has your interest in perhaps more theoretical science grown over the years and worked its way into your art?
Well, part one, which is incorporated here in the Lafayette Show, is Mothership Postulations of Myth and Math. And I'm interested in the forecast, for instance, in about 30 years we'll be at 9 billion people. I'm interested in the scientists who are working. What land will we have to grow food on with climate change, with rising water? How much water will we have, fresh water? All of those kind of numbers. And it really doesn't add up to a pretty picture. And it almost, it does largely coincide with early myth predictions about end of time. So this is kind of scary. And I would turn to my interest in Stephen Hawking, the astrophysicist, who says that we have 100 years left, not to save Earth, but to leave her. Now, this is pretty extreme. So the Mothership series, particularly part two, as it comes to Lafayette, is saying, what if we have 100 years? What if that's true? So it takes that and runs with it a bit. But the curators asked, they said, well, Dawn, you're not fully pessimistic as Stephen Hawking. I said, well, no, to give up hope is to give up humanness. And that is kind of the go-to thing of myth anyway. It's another place we turn to, hope. And the good guy wins against the odds.
Now, the curators, you're talking about Brian Guidry and Mary Bate here
yes.
in Lafayette.
Yes.
And this is phase two, so you're adding some things on to what you initially started with. And we do have to say that you were a Rauschenberg fellow. And during that year, this past year, mm-hmm. you worked a lot on the Mothership series.
Absolutely. It was just an extraordinary opportunity, and we know Rauschenberg has connections here, and his wonderful sister is here, and thank you all for such an opportunity. And I did add to Mothership 2 while at the Rauschenberg Foundation in Captiva, Florida, working there with first responders and the scientists on Sanibel Island, and they greatly informed the show. I think what we'll see here, I have a piece that is, mind you, I mean, I'm talking about science, but I deal with icons. I deal with kind of giving a shape to metaphor. So you're not walking in and seeing data. But I'm trying to turn the science into some kind of poem that can resonate and impact emotionally, and maybe further change and activism that way. So I just want a disclaimer.
Yes,
you're not going to see grids of math and all of that.
Right.
You'll see mostly a lot of mythic images and site-specific for Lafayette. I'm doing a piece, if you can imagine, a latter-day Grapes of Wrath or kind of a Dust Bowl. So I have a piece dealing with the challenges facing us with agriculture and growing enough food. And then I did a piece, a big series of space clowns. We can't forget humor, can we? We have to laugh through it all. So
that's
anyway,
where the hope comes in.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And so particularly working with the first responders in Captiva, I have a series of kind of outlandish, clownish portraits of the first responders as space clowns. So that's brand new work and celebrates Rauschenberg. And I will say, to honor him, I brought back a coconut from a tree, a palm tree. It's not called a coconut, a palm date nut. I don't know what it is, but I'll find out by the time of the opening because I'll have it identified. But anyway, I brought that back from Captiva to put in my last room, which is souvenirs of Earth and just things that I am attached to. If I were to leave for my 100, you know, if my 100 years are up, what am I taking with me? So there are some sweet souvenirs, and one of which is this big nut from the Rauschenberg Foundation.
An interesting exercise for us all to think about. If you are just tuning in, my guest is artist Dawn Dido, a conceptual multimedia artist who has a new piece opening this Saturday for Second Saturday Art Walk at the Acadiana Center for the Arts. It's called Mothership, Dreaming of a Future Past. Well, let's talk about these layers. You've talked about some pieces that will be new to the series here in Lafayette, but let's start putting on the layers for people who are trying to conceptualize what you're talking about. And of course, they can go to your website and see some of the images as well.
Not really. I don't have any of this. Okay. I've been so busy the last few years making art, and here we're talking about me and technology, but I've been very lax. So don't go to my website.
Expecting to see exactly.
Just come see the show to start with. Come see the show. But in terms of layers, I think...
What did you begin with? What was your palette when you began Mothership?
I'll go back to that overlay, doing an overlay of mathematical projections and the myth. So the first thing I think you'll experience, and perhaps the most dominant in the show, is there's a pale horse, a life-size pale horse. And this ties into a really amazing thing that happened to me. We all know of Freud and Jung, and most of you out there do. Well, I kept having a dream when I started the Mothership show. I kept having a dream about a pale horse. I said, oh, there is no way I'm putting a horse in the show. That's so Freudian, I remember saying. But I kept dreaming about this horse, and so I looked it up, and it turns out that this pale horse is a universal symbol from disparate cultures, going from Korea, Persia, Romania, and of course coming into Western culture, we have it in even the Book of Revelations. So the pale horse is a symbol of either the end of time or a marking of triumph, even in the face of our ruin. So it's an interesting symbol, and I decided to put it in the show because it was my first and only true Jungian collective dream moment, and it was exhilarating, and it really comes from that. And the history, once I kept researching the horse, this is what I found out. So the horse takes center place, and again, tying into the what if of Stephen Hawking. What if 100 years? What if the pale horse is coming? The other important mythological symbol layer, as you say, is the ring. And if we take Hawking's line and we say, okay, there's 100 years left, not to save Earth, but to leave Earth, then Mothership is not the Earth, but a vessel to leave her. So I take my ring, my symbolic ring. It's the ring from the making of the Zeppelin, and it's the largest aircraft to date. I mean, they're trying to duplicate it now with Airbus and exceed it, but to date, this has been the big mothership. It didn't last very long in the sky, but it's a beautiful object, and I have a few pieces in the show that celebrate the construction of the Zeppelin, but more importantly, take the ring as key metaphor. And we know the Hobbit. The hobbits, of course, try to save the Earth by throwing the gold ring, the ring of power and greed, into the destroying it. Well, there are different rings that appear in so much mythology, even in we have it in Wagner's opera. So the ring keeps appearing, and it's the Alpha and Omega, and our connection, I think, to time. So as a storyteller, a narrative-based artist, I came up with my own mythology, my own ring, and this ring is representing in this large scale our relationship, our dysfunctional marriage with technology. And it's a marriage we cannot divorce ourselves from at this point. While technology led us into this precarious, perhaps perilous time, without technology at this point, we're doomed. So we have to redefine and nurture also our relationship and our stewardship and responsibility of technology. So those are the two key metaphors in the show for me.
And when you say Zeppelin, that's still a gripping image to many people. It's still such a strange, a powerful image to a lot of people, the sheer size of it, the unusual shape of it. And it does something to our imaginations even today.
It sure does. And if you imagine, my early interest, as I said, was class and race. Imagine that we really do have to leave. Who gets on board? How many ships are there? You know, it really pulls everything together. Who wins the lottery ticket? Not that it's a good place to go. But anyway, there's going to have to be many, many a Zeppelin, right?
That would be an interesting thing to have a little kiosk at your exhibit selling lottery tickets.
That's a good idea for a performance piece. We'll let someone else
do it.
I've kind of moved out of that with the
Right. So you've got these powerful images that have been interesting to you for a long time. The idea of the ring, technology, spaceships, whether they're Zeppelin-like or whatever they look like. And then the horse, though, which is not technology, which is a very old but yet extremely powerful image that haunts people's dreams even today. How did you make it incarnate in your exhibit? What does that look like when people see that image? How have you created it?
Well, I had it fabricated in Mexico, great craftsman, which I can't take credit for actually fabricating it. I did the drawings, but it's done in aluminum, and I thought when I got it, I would stain it and paint it white, but it already shimmers and is pale, and the metallic horse seemed a perfect kind of meeting point with the technology. So I decided to leave it aluminum and rough sanded, and it also when I got it, it reminded me too of the Trojan horse and a lot of other aspects of mythology. As you say, this goes back so extensively in mankind's history. It just seems to fit. Sometimes you don't question it, and this was I'll repeat, a real extraordinary moment for me to have this dream, several dreams of this. And it's a time I can say in my career where I'm letting go, and I'm allowing myself to be a little whimsical and or extravagant, and that I follow the dream, and I don't necessarily have to connect the dot.
Mm-hmm,
maybe the
mm-hmm.
dots will connect themselves. Now that's a far
that's
saying a lot, and it's not normally my style. Mm-hmm. But in this case, that's what I did. I took that artistic license. And I think the dots do connect, but mm-hmm. I'm just lucky there.
Well, and allowing yourself to enter that stream, that
yeah.
stream of symbols, you know, that Jung and they all touch on, this
yeah.
idea that there are common symbols and that we feel things very intimately with certain symbols. But now the horse, and I guess I want you to describe this, because it doesn't just sit on the floor. You don't just walk in and it's sitting on the floor. How do you have him positioned?
Well, as Mary Bate would say, we have him on a pedestal. He's on a giant wall.
Mm-hmm.
In the previous manifestation, he was up high on a ledge, and he looks down into a reflection of himself, a two-dimensional kind of pool-like reflection, an image embedded in acrylic, so it looks like it's floating in water. In this case, it's on the top of one of their movable walls, and it really does function as a very high pedestal. It's, I think, a powerful installation. And instead of putting the reflection, we're debating this now. You will either see the horse in his looking at his reflection, the front side, or it may be in the back, because as we were lighting the piece, we now have the shadow of the horse that looks into the reflection. So we're still playing that out, and you'll have to come see the exhibition to find out what we at last determined. But that's how it's situated, very dominant in the show.
Well, and if you are finding yourself fascinated by what my guest is talking about, her exhibit Mothership opens at the Acadiana Center for the Arts this Saturday for Second Saturday Art Walk. Mothership is an evolving series of exhibits. This is the second phase. There are some very unique pieces that Dawn has created for the Lafayette Show that will also then move to New Orleans for Prospect 3 in the fall, and you can see how it evolves at that point as well. So lots of of interesting pieces, again, very unique in particular to this Lafayette show, including some of these extremely powerful mythic images, the horse, the ring, and just a wonderful way to grapple with some of these issues we're talking about environment and the future and our place here on Earth. So many aspects, so many layers that you have here. And again, my guest, Dawn, an artist in Louisiana for many decades now, so many awards. Her work is all around the country in different museums, contemporary museums. You yourself are one of the founding members of the Contemporary Art Center in New Orleans on the first board.
Yes.
And in fact, you just received an award this year from them, a very high award from the Contemporary Art Center in New Orleans. So a great opportunity for all of us here in Lafayette to experience your work and to be a part of this exhibit, this evolving exhibit as well. And so, Dawn, can you kind of give us an idea about how it will evolve, or is that something?
Yes, I can. Mm-hmm. Yes, I can. And I'm going from the macro, the big, big picture. And as it leaves Lafayette and goes to New Orleans, it's going to tighten up its focus very specifically on the Louisiana coast, on our here and now. So we go from macro to micro. And I'll be adding a few large epic pieces, I think, of the Louisiana coastline and as it's separating, as the water is claiming the land. And the piece will go to a new riverfront building developed by Tulane Center for Bioenvironmental Research together with their affiliate, a studio in the woods. So they'll be the host site, and it'll be a Prospect 3 Plus installation. And in addition to the – and it also gets a bit funky because I'm taking on utopia, the idea of utopian quest. So there's a swamp galaxy aspect and a tribute to George Clinton, who did the first mothership, and to Sun Ra, Space is the Place, and to taking a look at utopia, particularly through the culture of civil rights movement in America, how they wanted to even leave Earth because to find equality somewhere else. So that's one thing that will receive some tight focus. And then working very much, actually trying to bring art, politics, and scientists together. And I'm very grateful to Jonathan Perry, Fred Mills, Terry Landry, Jack Monashek, Stephen Ortego, I think, and Vincent Pierce, because they have been working very much from this area, pro-environment, and hopefully they will continue working with us in New Orleans. We hope to enlarge that pool of representatives to work with us to save the environment.
Well, I was going to ask you where you take your hope from, but it sounds like you do have a lot of hope in what's happening here in the state with younger people very interested in the environment. So your hope doesn't just come from the humorous parts of your exhibit,
no.
But that you actually see good things that are happening, people trying to help this mothership. And
it's really wonderful. I'm so grateful to the younger generations for what you're doing with your social media, quickly to rally around causes, your recycling, your water conservation, your energy conservation. Bravo. Keep it up. I mean, if you don't do that, we're doomed. And I'm so pleased that a lot of our politicians are jumping on board. Of course, we need the rest of you to help, and we have to close up those canals and really try to save our coastline. So,
well, a good place to start is this Saturday at the Acadian Center for the Arts to experience emotionally a lot of these ideas that Dawn is talking about. Again, my guest, Dawn Dido, artist, a conceptual artist, multimedia artist in Louisiana, one of the first pioneering this artwork in Louisiana. Her work shown all over the country. We have an opportunity to see Mothership this Saturday, the second phase of Mothership at the Acadiana Center for the Arts in the main gallery, and then continue on in the fall. We can follow you, Mothership groupies, and follow that journey on.
Well, Lafayette will be an important part of New Orleans, so I do hope that we continue this I-10 corridor. I think it's great that we're sister cities in the truest sense of the word now culturally, and so I do hope that Lafayette feels very much a part of the New Orleans showcase.
Okay, well, we'll see you on the Mothership this Saturday.
Yes. All aboard.
It starts at around 5:30, 6 o'clock. 5:30,
I think 6, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you can enjoy Art Walk all evening as well, but you might find yourself really engrossed in Dawn's piece, Mothership.
Thank you so much, and thanks to the Acadian Center for the Arts. Thank you.
Thank you, Dawn.